Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Bennett, an astrophysicist and author on a mission to make math and science accessible to everyone. He's written best-selling college textbooks, 7 award-winning children's books read out loud by astronauts on the ISS, and co-led the Voyage Scale Model Solar System on the National Mall. He joins us today to talk about his latest book, The Scale of the Universe. So, Jeff, what kind of person were you in college, and did your dreams and aspirations at the time pan out exactly to what you're doing today?
That's a really interesting question. So in some ways, yes, and in some ways, my path changed. I was actually a biophysics major in college rather than astrophysics, but I was very focused on education. I actually took what is now called a gap year between my freshman and sophomore years to start working in elementary school. I kept working at the elementary school through the rest of my undergrad years. I ran my own summer school for elementary and middle school kids about space and science for a few years. And I made the switch after watching Carl Sagan explain how incredibly cool astronomy and space science is. And I decided that since I love teaching so much, that would be the direction that I wanted to go in for graduate school and for my career.
Funny, because you slightly reminded me of Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I think that might have been spot on because you were inspired by Carl Sagan. What specifically inspired you?
Well, he just made it seem so incredibly cool and important to understand how we fit into the universe. And I had already always liked it and was interested in it already, but that combination of him showing that and the teaching that I had been doing made me realize this was a place where I thought I could have an impact. And interestingly, Neil and I both got our PhDs at almost exactly the same time and had our careers focused on the same types of things with slightly different emphasis in each of our cases. I actually met him for the first time at a thesis defense meeting for the American Astronomical Society.
That's very cool. What's the one thing people get wrong about the solar system or the universe at whole?
I think that part of what got me really focused on teaching about scale was that people really get the scale wrong. They always vastly underestimate how big things are, how spread out things are out there. Perhaps because NASA shows these beautiful montages of planets and moons, it can make it look like space is crowded, the solar system's crowded, but it's not. It's really, really empty. As I like to say, there's a reason we call it space.
I would say the same applies to time as well. We're really bad at imagining things at such a scale, and especially it's just a time frame. And it's why certain elements like Darwinian evolution is really hard for us to absorb. Because we can have a conversation how evolution can operate at a very narrow scale, and we'd all agree on those things. Just like how bacteria, viruses, how all of that evolves at a small scale, we would all agree this all makes sense. But to take an amoeba and turn it into a monkey, I think that's a little bit harder to reconcile. But the truth is, it's the same series of logic. It's just processed over a much grander time frame. And I think the same applies to the universe. It's extremely hard for us to understand how vast this universe is and what nothing really means. There are multiple degrees of depth of what you can attribute to the word nothing.
That's right. And the scale of both space and time, you're exactly right. They're both incredibly difficult to comprehend. And so what we try to do, what I try to do in particular, is to find ways to try to break that down so that you can gradually build across your understanding in ways that make sense to get some sense of what these incredible space and time scales really mean.
Broadly speaking, let's say the three scales that we are privy to is the quantum mechanical scale, the Newtonian scale, the one that we experience here, and then the Einsteinian scale, the space-time general relativity scale. Why does it seem to us that the rules of physics operate so differently at these scales? And why do we assume that there must be one elegant, parsimonious function to describe the universe as a whole? And then if that's the case, if there is one, how come these three different scales feel so different?
Well, we can kind of see them all operating on all the scales together. And that's why we assume there is this one thing. For example, you know, when you look out to vast distances at stars and galaxies, we can see that they're producing light, producing spectral lines by the same quantum mechanical processes that we can observe happening creating those spectral details in the laboratory. So we know that even though these things are incredibly far away, they're behaving the same on the atomic and subatomic scales as things right here on Earth. So we actually do have evidence that they operate the same across all these scales and across the universe. Now, that said, we don't understand these things in full detail. For example, we know that general relativity and quantum mechanics, if you go down to the very smallest scales, they become incompatible with each other. And we don't know how to resolve that issue yet. So physics still has a ways to go in understanding that.
So I actually had a podcast with someone else who held the high position at NASA, and we stumbled into the conversation of unification theory and reconciling gravity with quantum mechanics. And he mentioned that my assumption that there should be a unification theory is a false one, and that there might not necessarily be a single formula to explain life as we know it. What's your opinion on that?
Well, until we find it, we don't know if it exists, right? So yes, the working assumption in physics is that there is such a thing, which is why people spend careers trying to find it. But if it doesn't exist, then maybe we're going in directions that aren't very productive. But so far, I think people are optimistic that that will turn out to be the case. Until we find it, we won't know.
And when do you believe the pursuit and passion for science should begin? Do you believe it's at a really young age? Do you believe it's when we're in college? And what would you say society has gone wrong about making science as cool as it should be?
Well, I think science is a very innate human process. When I talk to little kids and we talk about what is science, I always explain science is basically just a very simple process. It's observing things carefully and then thinking very carefully about what you've observed and how to make sense of it. That's the essence of science across the board. And that's a very natural human thing to do, which is why I think we're all interested in science as kids. You never run into kids who don't love science. As we get older, our education system sometimes pushes it out of them. So I think the biggest failures occur at those points along the way where we take the joy and the natural innate curiosity about science away from kids and it turns them off. But oftentimes you'll find adults then coming back to it and going, gosh, I wish I had kept studying that all along.
Yeah. I think the scientific method has progressed the quality of human life more than any other discipline possibly could. We can go back 100 years ago to where I think it was Max Planck was looking to enter the field of physics, and his professor told him, I think there's just a few things left, like black body radiation. You're pretty much at the end of this road.
Kelvin's two clouds over physics.
Yeah. And believe it or not, I think they were barely touching the surface. But even then today, you're looking, what discipline should you focus on? And even math, I graduated in math, and it's like, you can either leverage math in other capacities, which people tend to respect. You can become an actuary or you can become a professor. It didn't seem like there was so much you could do with like the hard sciences. And I imagine physics is not all that different. And I think that explained why so many people don't pursue science, because stuff like finance pays so much better. And you really got to be willing to give up a lot and be completely in love with the passion to head down that road.
Well, I think that's true. And I think a lot of people are focused in that way. They do have that passion. They want to understand things. They want to be curious and have a way to engage with material. But I also like to point out, particularly to college students, that if you get a degree in science, even if you don't end up pursuing science, if you move into finance from your math degree like you did, it's great preparation. So there's no downside to following that pathway because you'll be ready for anything that comes along.
I actually completely agree with you, Jeff. I wasn't saying necessarily it was a bad choice to make, but I think like as a direct application, there's not a lot there, but it is incredibly leverageable. And I would say that as someone who studied both computer science and math, this is a strange thing to say, but I genuinely feel that math helped me for computer science way more than computer science ever could. It gave me one more layer deeper to how I approach and see problems. I always speak to people who are looking to go in college. They say, hey, Michael, what do you recommend I do? And I always say, do the thing that you're less likely to learn anywhere else. Pick the hardest path, pick the thing that puts the most stress on you, put the thing that allows you to achieve that greatest delta in the shortest period of time. And it's usually the hardest sciences, like physics and math, and even philosophy, which I seem to have found really fascinating, dabbling with a course or two. People go, no, I'll just do, you know, something that's just a little easier. And I always wonder how to get across to those people.
Well, it can be a challenge because these majors can be hard. I know from my own kids, when they're studying these hard majors, they're not able to go out and have quite as much fun as some of their other friends might be doing. But that said, the fact that there's limited numbers of people in them is also what makes them, in part, what such a great opportunity, because you're going to stand out more. I saw somewhere at one point that physicists had the highest probability of acceptance to law school of any major. And it's not because physics necessarily prepared them for law school. I think it's because they stand out in the application. They did this really hard major. If you did that, they figure you're going to succeed in law school too.
And it also gives you a unique perspective on different industries. So if you're approaching law from physics, you're likely to have more of an innovative mindset than someone who's taken that well-molded path that millions of others took as well.
That's right. And there's also nowadays in law, there's a lot of cases that involve really understanding technology and science in a fair amount of depth if you're going to represent your clients well.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. The center of the universe syndrome, what's that?
So I think that the most important lesson that to me that we've learned from all our study of science and astronomy over the last few hundred years is that we're not the center of the universe. The universe is this enormous old thing. We're a tiny piece of it. And I think once you understand that, and Carl Sagan talked about this very eloquently in his famous Pale Blue Dot speech, if you really understand that, you're led to realize we all need to figure out how to get along and to be tolerant of each other and to care about each other and to take good care of this planet. And so center of the universe syndrome is the term that I use to describe people who have not taken that message to heart, and therefore instead tend to act as though they think the universe revolves around them and they're the most important thing. And so I would argue those people cause pretty much all the problems in the world.
Yeah. And I think that mindset always leaves us humbled. And I always wonder where that stops, because at first we thought we were the center of the universe around this planet. And then we see the sun, we think the sun revolves around us. And then we realize we're wrong. There's other planets. We're in a solar system. And then we realize, oh, wow, this whole solar system was created for us. And then we realize we're wrong. There's galaxies. And then there's universes. And oh, wow, this universe is made for us. I wonder if that stops there. And then we can just keep extrapolating outwards and perhaps we're wrong again and there's a multiverse.
Well, that's a possibility too, although I tend to go in a slightly different direction there, which is that if you think about all these times we thought we were somehow central and then learned that we were wrong, the one piece that we have not definitively answered yet is whether we're the center of the biological universe in the sense of, are there others like us out there? Are there other civilizations out there? And I'm very confident we will eventually find out that there are other civilizations out there, but we have not yet found that out. But once we do, that'll be kind of the final piece of we're not the center of anything. And in fact, it's very likely that there's many species out there that are far, far more technologically advanced than we are.
Some of them might just be right in front of us. We just don't have the same modes for communication. The concept of life can take on such an abstract form. We're looking at carbon-based life, but if you go down the periodic table, you can have silicon-based life, which can create highly complex molecules. And the concept of silicon-based, like, it would be such a foreign concept to us. We only have one example of life. And I wonder, if this universe is so vast, how come we haven't had any signs of life? And I think this comes down to Enrico Fermi's famous Fermi paradox. How do you reconcile these two facts, how this universe should be teeming and exploding with life, yet we haven't really had any definitive signs of any?
Well, I think the primary reason we haven't had any definitive signs of any is the same vastness that makes you think there should be lots out there. It's too far and too big. We do not yet have the technology that really allows us to check whether there is any life out there. We're only just beginning. It's only 30 years since we discovered the first planets orbiting other stars. And to date, we know about them almost entirely through indirect detection. We can't even get a picture with a single pixel in, 99% or more of the cases. So we just aren't there yet technologically to be able to answer that question. I suspect that when we are, perhaps in a few decades, we'll start to find the evidence of that life. And perhaps the first place is going to be Mars, although that will just be very simple, microscopic life.
So I always thought about that. Let's just say we do find fossilized life on Mars. That still might not answer the question, because the theory of panspermia, where life came from perhaps Mars onto our planet, it could likely be that we're still looking at the same originating source, which would be fascinating, but also slightly depressing because it doesn't give us this process can repeat itself everywhere. And to add to that element of despair, we can be trapped in our own galaxy cluster because you can have galaxies both pushing away, not necessarily at the speed of light, but at a cumulative speed, pushing in opposite directions. And I guess with our primitive understanding of physics, it just might be impossible to leave one galaxy cluster and enter another.
Let's start with the Mars question. There might be ways to tell, for example, if it uses a completely different chemistry, then it would presumably come from a different origin of life. But that is an important point that you raise, that Venus, Earth, and Mars all have been exchanging material for billions of years. And we know that in some cases, there are microbes that could survive the journey between those places. So whichever one of the three got life first is very likely to have sent that life to the other two at some point. Now, when you go out to the stars, I think that the numbers are just so enormous, even in a single galaxy, right? One of the things I like to talk about is if you take 100 billion stars, which is actually a very conservative number for the Milky Way galaxy, our own single galaxy, if you wanted to count those 100 billion stars out loud and you did it at a rate of 1 per second, it would take you 100 billion seconds, which is more than 3,000 years just to count. Yeah. The stars. And so the number of possibilities is so enormous. I don't think we have to worry about things like the expansion of the universe and what its effects might be to look for incredible possibilities.
Yeah. And we'll get back to that in just a second, because you said something fascinating. You said that some forms of primitive life can travel the distances of space. And I think the important perspective here is, why can they? Evolution is normally dictated by its environment. And to have such an aggressive attribute to survive the vastness of space with incredible radiation and a deprived food source and incredible temperatures, there's an element of evolution here that makes you wonder, is maybe they evolved to do that. They didn't naturally have that. And that in itself can raise the argument that perhaps we've underestimated the fact that primitive life is better at traversing the universe than we are. By a long shot. And that makes the conversation even more interesting.
It could be, but I think there's also an evolutionary way to look at it. Life, when it first started on Earth, was in a high intensity radiation environment with temperature extremes and everything else, because Earth did not have the kind of atmosphere it has today. So you can argue that it was inevitable that life would evolve to be able to repair radiation damage, to survive different extremes, and so on. And some of that just translates into space. I should note that in terms of how long microbes can survive in space, we don't know a definitive answer, but there's pretty good reason to think it can survive. Some forms can survive decades, but not thousands or millions of years. So we're not going to see life exchanged between star systems, but between planets. Venus, Earth, and Mars have been exchanging material. The reason is because when an asteroid comes in and slams into the ground, it blasts some stuff into orbit. And some of that will get escape velocity and head towards the other planets. Most of that will spend millions of years in space. Probably any life that's included would die. But every once in a while, there's a low probability orbit that will take a meteor from Earth to Mars or vice versa in 10 to 20 years.
I quickly want to pull this back to the Fermi paradox, because you raised a good point. You said, even if we can't leave our local galaxy cluster, there's still so many planets that life surely must be found somewhere. And I think we're fighting probabilities with really big numbers. There are billions and billions of planets, but how rare are the environments to create life truly are? And when you try to come up with solutions to the Fermi paradox, one of the categories are great filters. And the hope is that a great filter is behind us, not ahead of us.
Right.
Because if a great filter is ahead of us, it could be that this right here happens all the time. And when we look into the universe, we're really just looking into a graveyard of life. Let's just say for like 15,000 years, we were smart enough to even just look into the sky and ask basic questions. That is a blip in time in the process for life. And life can spawn all the time. But the problem is it doesn't last very long. And one of the examples could be is that we are infinitely more likely to kill ourselves than we are to develop the technology to spread out. Like our understanding of splitting the atom can come way before our ability to create interplanetary space travel or travel to even our closest star system of Alpha Centauri, which is 4.5 light years away, or the concept of photosynthesis. There's so many things that can be considered great filters. If if photosynthesis would be one of them, then we'd be lucky. We have passed that great filter. So the argument that this universe or a galaxy can be popping in and out of life, but it really depends on like, what are those variables that make life really happen?
Right. I like to say that you can categorize possible solutions to the Fermi paradox. Why haven't we detected other intelligent life forms yet? Into three basic categories. And you've picked on one of the three. So the first one is that they're just not out there. That just seems, it's possible because we haven't detected any yet, but it seems so highly improbable given the numbers that usually I kind of say, I doubt it. Then the second possibility is your great filter idea, the idea that somehow once you reach our level of civilization, you pretty much inevitably destroy yourself. And that unfortunately feels very real. If you take this position that we're not central to the universe, and other civilizations that rise up would have risen up through similar evolutionary pressures, predator-prey relationships, things like that, just as we did. And so you would imagine that any civilization would reach this point that we have, where we both have the ability to begin traveling into space, but also the ability to destroy ourselves in innumerable different ways. And so it could be that nobody makes it through this filter. Mm. Could very well be the answer to the Fermi paradox, but we hope it's not, because if it is, it would say that we're doomed. And so therefore, we want to assume either that it's not, or that we might be the first ones to find our way through it. And if it's not the answer to the Fermi paradox, and if it's not that we are alone, you're left with the third possibility, which is that the universe has already been colonized by advanced civilizations, and it's just a matter of time until we meet them. And that, of course, is the premise of Carl Sagan's famous novel and movie Contact, which is well worth watching for anyone who hasn't seen it or reading the book.
Yeah. Let's just hope, Stephen Hawking said that when we encounter species that are way more advanced than us, that how that concept generally played out on Earth, where maybe there's a reason why different life forms in space don't announce themselves out of the fear of getting hunted, and we're out there just throwing radio waves.
The good news is, and I talk about this a bit in my Scale of the Universe book, once you understand how far it is to travel among the stars and how difficult that is, you realize that anyone with the technology to get here doesn't need anything from us.
Right. That's such a great point. And that can pull us closer to today here, where you can take that same concept and look at it as an argument with AI. We all believe that AI is going to surpass human intelligence and not even look back. It's going to blow right through it. And the question becomes, this is going to be a real threat. And I don't think that AI would be malicious towards us. It will just become entirely irrelevant towards it. That's the real threat, I believe. We will become entirely irrelevant. And in fact, us holding the levers is going to become the greatest liability. It's like monkeys who found a way to build nuclear power plants, and they're constantly asking it to make more nuclear power plants so they can have more bananas. There's a philosophical gap here that's going to arise.
Yeah, there's a lot of different directions that it could end up going. And I think it's very important that we think through these possibilities as we're creating these things, rather than just letting them happen on their own.
And hopefully we got some control of that process. You mentioned the center of the universe syndrome. I wanted to ask your opinion. Maybe we should just throw people in space for a few days and give them a bit of the overview effect, and perhaps they'll get a bigger picture. And for those who don't know what the overview effect is, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
It's this idea that when the astronauts go up into space and they see how the Earth looks from up above, they get a new perspective on thinking about our planet and ourselves. And I think that's a very real thing for most astronauts. And it's not realistic for us to imagine sending everybody up into space, at least not these days. But I think that you can still get that same sense by thinking about space enough and understanding it and trying to picture it. And that, again, is why I think talking about the scale of things is so important, because that's how you can develop that sense without having to travel out into space yourself. But I'm all in favor of sending people with center of the universe syndrome out there.
It sounds amazing every time I hear an astronaut talk about it. And you mentioned Carl Sagan. So he had this analogy of flatlanders. You have these 2D beings existing in a 2D world, but if you're able to pluck one out for just a second, you'll be able to see into a three-dimensional world where this being can now see any point in place in this two-dimensional field. It'll blow your mind. And it's all about like taking a step up and getting a broader perspective that can completely change. And you realize how trivial the stuff that we kill each other over, random or arbitrary just positions in land. We kill over our religion. Unfortunately, not everyone, but just these things that are almost like so hurtful and wasteful to be killing one another over really truly doesn't matter when you see the bigger picture.
Right. And when you realize that if we want to survive, if we want to avoid that great filter type of problem, it's going to require us learning how to get along with each other and taking care of this world.
I want to get your opinion on some of the declassified documents in the U.S. government on UFOs or unidentified aerial phenomenon, EAPs. So what's your opinion on all that?
Well, I think President Obama actually was interviewed about this, and he had what I think is the best answer, which is that having seen from his position how bad the government is at keeping secrets, if there really was any smoking gun evidence there, it would have been exposed long ago. What are we seeing? I think what we're seeing is that there are things that we don't have explanations for. It doesn't automatically make them alien spaceships.
Yes. This is a different kind of conversation, though. And that's a completely rational response. You always got to assume the most obvious possibility. But the footage is overwhelming. And the behavior depicted in those footage make it evident that that's not a product of human ingenuity.
I don't really focus too much in this area, but I have friends who do. And they have told me that they think all that footage has alternative explanations.
Really? That's fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. For example, the famous Navy one with the lights darting off, you can reproduce that with a single engine private plane off in the distance and the same camera.
Really?
Apparently, according to my friends. Yeah.
Because here's the thing. Some of these pilots are not like random people strolling outside. These are people who live in the skies and they have incredible expertise and they do this all the time. So to see them react in such a form of shock and awe is something that should be paid attention to. At some point, you're really splitting hairs to make sense of these videos. Like, you have to create it in this and that way.
We can acknowledge that we don't understand what it is they saw, and we believe that they saw something. But the range of optical illusions that can occur, the way our brains might interpret certain signals and so on, it is quite enormous. So to jump from we don't know what they saw and we don't have an explanation for it to aliens and spacecraft, that's the place where I would say that's not a smart leap to make.
Yeah, fair enough. And now I want to talk about this three-pronged revolution at our doorstep. So we have quantum computing, or we're moving towards quantum supremacy. We have the race towards general artificial intelligence, and then we have the seamless flow of organized data in blockchain. And I think each of these revolutions in and of themselves are going to change life as we know it. And it certainly feels like it's going to be one of those things where the sum is greater than the parts. Do you feel like we have any predictive power of where this is going?
Don't, because these are not areas that I have much expertise in. Whether some people might have predictive powers there, I'm not convinced from what I read, because I think we don't know exactly where they're all going. And generally speaking, one of the things I used to talk about with alien civilizations and what their technology might be is the fact that 50 years ago nobody predicted the internet,
right?
Or 50 years before it started, nobody predicted it. And so for us to imagine that we're now able to predict what's going to happen 50 years from now, when technology has been accelerating, if anything, would somewhat unrealistic. But perhaps there's people who have an idea.
To go back just a few hundred years and say that you can have this thing you hold in your hand that can send a message across the world in less than a split second would have the craziest of witches burned at the stake for saying such a crazy thing. And we get text messages today and we're not surprised whatsoever. And that delta is going to change. You don't even need to go back to the times of witches. You can really just look at the evolution of the iPhone over the past 20 years. It started off being this thing that's so cool. It played your music and now it literally does everything else. And it just looks chaotic. It looks like our predictive power is truly fleeting. And any guess of what the future be like is pure speculation.
Right. But I think it's really important, again, for us to go into this possible future with our eyes open and some forethought. And looking back over the last century or so, the discovery of nuclear weapons, biotechnology, and genetic engineering, those are both things that were recognized as having enormous potential, but also enormous dangers. And as a result of that, we created ways of managing it, not perfectly, obviously, but we haven't had a nuclear war because we've had some control over who gets them and how they're governed. We haven't had a major bio disaster because of rules that were put in place for scientific researchers and so on. And one of my fears right now is that we're moving forward into this new era without any of those types of safeguards in place. And I think it's important for us to start thinking about that.
Yeah, the concern is really Murphy's Law here. It's not about like saving civilization at the 11th hour. It's just a matter of time till every scenario plays itself out. And even like the concept of nuclear terrorism, where maybe nuclear weapons in 200 years from now won't be something that only well-organized governments can put together. But it's all an interesting place to be in, and I really hope we do start to head to other planets before. And speaking of leaving this one, how did Storytime from Space come about, and what was it like hearing your books being read from orbit?
Alvin Drew, an astronaut, and Patricia Tribe, who at the time was the director of education at Space Center Houston, they came up with the idea of reading kids' books from space and decided that since Alvin was going up on a mission shortly thereafter, that they would just do it. Astronauts get a little bit of free time, so he was going to read a book and maybe get his crewmates to do that too. And then they started talking about what book to read, and apparently they picked mine, Max Goes to the Moon, because
That's
they
crazy.
Liked the combination of the science and the story and the dog. And they called me up and said, can we read your book from space? And it took them a few minutes to convince me it wasn't a prank call. But that was the origin of that program. And after Alvin did his first reading from a PDF on his computer screen on the Space Shuttle Discovery, then they started launching the physical books up into space to the space station after that.
Jeff, you should be so proud of yourself. That is like such a cool achievement to have someone read your book from space. That's amazing.
Yeah, my books have traveled hundreds of millions of miles on the space station. So
how are you going to top that?
I don't think I can.
So where do you see yourself in 10 years from now?
Well, keep working on new projects. We did a movie of Max Goes to the Moon as a planetarium show more than a decade ago, and we're working on Max Goes to Mars right now. Hopefully that'll be out to planetariums around the world and streamable online by the end of this year. My textbook work keeps me pretty busy most of the time because those are in constant need of updates as things change rapidly in the fields that I work in. So I'll be doing those things, and if I think of a few more children's book ideas or general public book ideas, maybe I'll take a stab at those.
You've been in the industry for so long. When you're like a professor and you've studied a specific discipline for so long, it becomes really hard to discern what's complicated and what's not. So how do you navigate the fact that you have so many years of experience in such a specific discipline? How do you feel confident that you're making it properly digestible for children who have no exposure to this?
Mainly by going out and talking to kids, right? I go to elementary schools all the time. Been to more than 200 elementary schools now. And so I can see their reactions and I can talk to them and get their questions. So I get an ongoing sense of where they're coming from. I think it's just always trying to see, if I didn't know anything, would this explanation make sense?
Is there anything specific that you found fascinating coming from the mind of a child who has never been told how things should or shouldn't be? Any specific questions or statements that stuck with you?
There's probably tons of them, but I think one of the things that has stood out to me for many years now in my elementary school visits is when I'm talking to the kindergartners and first graders, I always will start out, if I'm reading them Max Goes to the Moon, by asking them whether it's a true story or not. And consistently for 20 years now, more than half the kindergartners and first graders assume that it is a true story. And what that tells me is that kids are growing up with this belief that we are going to the moon already. The fact that Artemis went to the moon is a surprise to them in that, aren't we doing that all the time? As opposed to, wow, we finally did it. And so I think kids are growing up with this belief in human possibilities, and we need to build on that and not shatter it by saying, no, we can't do that stuff.
If you were given the keys to the schooling system and said, let's have it your way, what would be the first thing you'd change?
I think that the key to this, to schools, is teachers. If you have a good teacher, they will make learning fun and interesting. So what I would do is make teaching careers much more attractive to people so that we get good teachers all the time. And there's lots of great teachers out there, but a lot of them will start out and then leave the field because they get frustrated by bureaucracy or low salaries or other things. So I would make teaching a profession that's much more highly regarded and something that people really want to aspire to, and then give teachers all the support they need to help teach their kids.
Yeah, good answer. Tell me about your new book, The Scale of the Universe.
So this is the book where I try to take you through the different scales. So we start with the scale of the Earth-Moon system, which I can tell you right there, if you ask people to scale, show them a globe for the Earth and a little ball about fist size for the moon, and ask them how far away it should be. 99.9% of people put the moon way too close to Earth, surprisingly far away. And then we jump from there to the scale of the solar system using this Voyage scale model that we've built on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. and in other places around the country. Then we jump to the scale of the galaxy and the scale of the universe. And then I go out to the scale of time after that using Carl Sagan's cosmic calendar motif, if you remember that. So it's really designed to be a very, very simple book to help you understand the scale of things. It's all done in question and answer format, so you can choose which questions really interest you. There's first level questions that I hope everyone would want to understand. Second level questions that go into more detail on some of the ideas if you want that.
Jeff, how can people get in touch with you?
You go to my website, jeffreybennett.com or bigkidscience.com. I've got my email on there. Easy enough to reach me, jeff@bigkidscience.com.
What a great conversation. From just exposing people who are early along the journey to science to talking about the vastness of the universe. This was an awesome conversation, Jeff. And thank you so much for your time and wisdom.
Thank you very much. It's really fun to talk about these things.